All right. So we are going to wrap up Jephthah tonight, I believe. And then we'll just jump into Samson. And I think that's all we're going to do with the judges and maybe with these Bible characters. I may go in a different direction after Samson. I talked about doing Paul, but one of these days I'm going to do it. Maybe next year sometime we'll just do a real deep study on Paul. That will necessitate it would be a real long class on Job. I mean on Paul rather. Sorry. But I would like to do that. But so maybe next year sometime we'll do that. So after Samson, we'll probably go in a different direction. But finishing up on Jephthah, we've seen, of course, we know by now that he grew up in difficult situation. His mother was a prostitute. His parents were immoral, really. His brothers didn't like him. They cast him out. So he grew up in Tob and hung around reckless and worthless fellows. But we've seen that he, because of his great leadership, was able to pull them together and really developed what became a great army. Might be too strong of a word, since there probably wasn't enough to call them that. But they were a band of warriors, and he gained the reputation himself as being a mighty warrior, a man of valor. And so as the Israelites are being oppressed by the Ammonites, they think of this Jephthah and decide to go ask for his help, which we saw that he gave that to them. Yeah, a little pushback at first there because they had neglected their duties with regard to being the overseers, the elders of Israel, protecting the people. They certainly didn't protect him. And so he mentioned that to them in his own words. But he agreed that they offered him to be the head of all of the Gileadites. And so he agreed with that and rather quickly defeated the Ammonites. We don't have a lot of information about that. It's just a few verses, really. The Lord was with him and they defeated their oppressors. And so we, of course, last week started to talk about these vows. We talked about that in detail last week. If you weren't here, the vow, really the silly vow that he made. We wouldn't be at a place to say it was just a dumb thing for him to do. Like, it was hasty. It made no sense. And so if you recall, the vow was that the first one out of the door, the door of my house, when I come back from the victory, will be yours. I will offer it as a sacrifice to you. Now, for those who weren't here last week, we basically said there's two positions on that. Early scholars take the position that it was a literal sacrifice that they offered, that he rather offered his daughter as a human sacrifice. Later scholars believe that he simply offered her as, committed her to service in the temple. And that would have been a huge sacrifice, certainly not as much as giving your life. But it would have meant she would have been a perpetual virgin, never having children, never having a husband. That would be, a existence that you wouldn't want thrust upon you. There were some women who agreed to that, wanted to do that. But to have that thrust upon you would be a difficult situation. And, of course, it would mean that Jephthah would... Remember, he didn't have any sons or daughters, so he would have no legacy going forward. So that would have been, if that is the position that you take, it would be a pretty big sacrifice. Now, let me just say one more thing about the other side of it that I didn't mention last week. That those who take the position that he actually literally offered his daughter up, that she became a human sacrifice. A couple of things about that. First of all, the scholars who would take that position generally take it because they look at his background. In other words, we've seen that his mother was a prostitute. I think I mentioned to you that she most probably was a Canaanite. And so they would take a position then that somehow she had some influence over him. We don't have record of his, you know, growing up years. So, but it would be the assumption that he spent some time, maybe considerable time, with his mother and had the influence of the Canaanite background. And that would make sense if you were thinking about a human sacrifice. Like, it was common for the Canaanites and for pagan nations in general to, before a war, to offer a human being as a sacrifice to their gods. That was common. That continued to be common for in pagan nations for centuries, even like the Vikings and things. And that's a, that was common for them to do. And so if Jephthah had that background and he was, again, you know, half Canaanite anyway, that, all right, we can see how he might come up with that. Okay, well, I'm about to go to war, want the help of God, but he had that background, so he made that vow. But again, you do what you will. You have to decide for yourself which direction you go with that. But it was a foolish vow, no matter how you look at it. He did expect, by the way, he expected a human being to come out of that door. Whatever he planned, whatever the vow consisted of, he didn't really think it was going to be a cow coming walking out of his door. I mean, he didn't think, you know, well, maybe a chicken to come out. So, no, he in fact, remember in verse 30 when it says, then whatever comes out from the doors of my house, my note there has whoever instead of whatever. And the reason for that is because the Hebrew is masculine, and Hebrew scholars would tell us that that means that he was referring to a person. So that's what he had on his mind. He was going to sacrifice in one way or another a person. Well, as I said last week, we want to spend some time then. The most practical look at this then is about this vow that he made. And that's important because we all have made vows. And the Bible has a lot to say about vow making. And so the first thing you think about with Jephthah is that he was willing to make a vow. And he made a vow to God. It shows that he had some faith in God. And we know, as I've been saying, he made it in onto the pages of Hebrews chapter 11. So he was a man of faith. You know, and how that developed in his life, we don't know, but he did great things for God. And so he was willing to make a vow. Are you willing to make a vow to God? And that is a question particularly to anyone who hasn't obeyed the gospel. A lot of people would refuse to obey the gospel, to make a commitment to God. And so, but that is a worthy thing. It shows again faith and trust in God. But as we stop and we think about that, one thing, you know, we have to think about Jephthah again. When it comes even to those who haven't obeyed the gospel, sometimes we're just, our hearts are probably in the right place. No doubt they are. But sometimes we want to rush people into the water and get them baptized. We need to baptize. And people sometimes then make a hasty decision, even though that decision is a great decision to obey the gospel of Christ. It's not a bad decision like a vow like Jephthah, but it still has to be thought through and considered. There are passages that teach us about that, like in Matthew chapter 8. Remember the familiar words of Jesus himself in Matthew chapter 8. Matthew the 8th chapter and beginning at verse 18. Matthew 8 at verse 18. It says this, Matthew the 8th chapter, verse 18. Now when Jesus saw a crowd around him, he gave orders to go over to the other side. And a scribe came up and said to him, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, foxes have holes and the birds of the air have their nest, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Another disciple said to him, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. Jesus said to him, follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead. And it's the idea of counting the cost. You know, if you're going to, when you begin to follow Jesus, it is a commitment. In fact, just quickly in Luke chapter 14, another passage that deals with the same basic thing, the idea of counting the cost. And you're familiar with these passages in the Gospels. But Luke chapter 14, and let's see, beginning at verse 25. Luke 14 at verse 25. Now, great crowds accompanied him, and he turned and said to them, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Now, whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Notice that. You cannot. The idea here, putting Jesus before everybody else. And if you're not willing to do that, you can't be a disciple of Christ. You won't be able to maintain discipleship. You won't be able to continue to follow Jesus. Too many things will get in the way. Things that you view as more important than him. And Jesus knew that. And so it's a hard saying, but it is true. For which of you desiring to build a tower does not first sit down and count the cost, whether he has enough to complete it. So that would be applicable to those who obey the gospel. Do we want people to be baptized? Of course. Of course we do. And let me ask, do you think Jesus wanted men to follow him even during his personal ministry? Of course he did. In fact, if you ever think that we need to baptize, we want people to be baptized, strong as you feel about that, I can guarantee you Jesus feels five times as strong about that. But he understands, we don't want to just get people wet. We want to just put them in the water, and they don't realize there is a cost that you have to pay to be a disciple of Christ. Well, now, let's jump from there then and think most of us here tonight are Christians. And so do we remember as Christians the vow that we made? Because that's what you did when you obeyed the gospel of Christ. You made a vow to God. And it's very important, we'll see in just a few minutes, it's very important that we keep the vows that we make. How are we going to do that if we forget really what we were committing ourselves to? It is a very important thing that we always... One thing we know about Jephthah, we may be in the dark a little bit about exactly what he sacrificed or what he even intended, but he knew what the vow consisted of. And we should too. I'm convinced that we sometimes forget. But we can't do that. We have to remember. Becoming a Christian is a real lifelong, lifetime commitment to Christ. And it involves sacrificing. It involves just being willing to follow him no matter what. And not just that. That's why I say it. We sometimes, you know, someone will want to be baptized and everybody's different. But sometimes we baptize young people and that's great. And sometimes real young people. And that, you know, again, every individual is unique. And so some people are ready to be baptized at a very young age. But just because you can ask someone a question and they say, yes, yet Jesus is the Son of God, or even, you know, what do you have to do? You have to hear, believe, repent, confess, and be baptized. That doesn't mean they understand what's involved in following Jesus. I mean, there's a real commitment there. But it's not just young people. How many of us sometimes, at least we live our lives as if we've kind of forgotten what's involved really in discipleship? And so do you know the vow that you made? Do you remember the vow that you made and exactly what you were committing yourself to? You were certainly committing yourself to serve God, to be a servant of God. in Romans chapter, in chapter 6, you remember. Romans, the 6th chapter. And at verse 18, listen to this. Romans chapter 6, at verse 18, it says, "And having been set free from sin, have become slaves of righteousness." You back up just verse 17. "But thanks be to God that ye were once slaves of sin and have become obedient from the heart to the standard of teaching to which you were committed, and having been set free from sin, have become slaves of righteousness." The interesting thing here is that, listen, we're all slaves to something. We're all servants to someone. Either God or the devil. Every single one of us. Everyone who has reached the age of accountability. It's only a matter who you want to serve. But being a Christian is about serving. And it begins with God. Being a servant to righteousness. He says, "I'm speaking in human terms because of your natural limitations. For just as you once presented your members as slaves to impurity and to lawlessness leading to more lawlessness, so now present your members as slaves to righteousness leading to sanctification." And you should have realized when you obeyed the gospel that that's what you were committing yourself to. We should have all realized that. We're committing ourselves to serve God. And that involves a life of purity, a life of godliness and righteousness. And that's what we committed to. Remember the vow that you made. It involves self-sacrifice. Remember over in Matthew chapter 16. Again, a passage that reads somewhat like the other ones, or at least puts us in mind of it. But Matthew chapter 16 at verse 24, Jesus says, he told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him do what? Deny himself." That's what Christianity is all about. That's the foundation, really, of being a good Christian. Self-denial. Being willing to deny yourself. If you don't have the spirit of self-denial, you'll never make it as a Christian, as a disciple of Christ. And Jesus knew that. That's why he's saying this to his disciples now. You have to be willing to deny yourself and take up your cross. That involves suffering and bearing burdens. And follow me, for whosoever will save his life will lose it, but whosoever will lose his life for my sake will find it. But self-denial, that would involve all kinds of things. We just make a list. It would involve self-ease. That's a part of self-denial. Are you willing to be uncomfortable for Christ? What do you do when life gets tough or there's struggles in life? A lot of people just throw up their hands and quit. They blame God, and "I'm disappointed, my life's a mess, and it's God's fault." Or even if they don't take that route, they still let it get in their way, and it stops them from serving God. What do you do in difficult times? That weaken your faith or strengthen your faith? Is that the time you run from God, or do you run to God in those difficult times of life? A lot of it depends on whether you're willing to deny yourself, and you deny yourself of that self-ease. You're able to go through a struggle, maintain your faith. There's a lot of self things. Self-confidence is a part of you have to deny. Learn to put your trust in God. Self-will. How many people are self-willed? The Bible has a lot to say about being self-willed. In fact, being self-willed would disqualify one from being an elder. Elder can't have that, you remember. But that's a problem for a lot of people. What does it mean to be self-willed? What do you have to have? If you're self-willed, what does that lead to? It's selfishness, huh? Right. You have to always have your way. That's a problem when you're trying to be a Christian. You can't be a Christian like that. And so, you know, you can't be self-willed. There's a lot of self that has to be given up in being a Christian. And again, you know, we may not understand everything that's involved in Christianity when we obey the gospel, but at the core, we should understand I'm making a commitment. I'm making a vow to God. And we should know what it is, at least generally speaking. We're going to have to put Christ first in our life. We should certainly know that. Sometimes we forget that. But that's a problem. Because, again, God takes vow making seriously. Turn your Bibles to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Notice this. Ecclesiastes chapter 5. And we'll just start at verse 1. And we could tie this into Jephthah, really. At verse 1, Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 1, guard your steps when you go to the house of God. To draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know what they are, that they are doing evil. Look, verse 2. Be not rash with your mouth. Now, that's always good advice, isn't it? But in the context here, he is basically dealing with vow making. Don't be too quick to make a vow. Like, vows are generally, in fact, they're always voluntary. You do that. Nobody makes you do that. So don't be too hasty. Think it through. Even if it's a good thing, you don't just go making a vow because it sounds good or you think someone else wants you to. Even if it is the vow you're making to God, you know, you have to be careful. Don't be rash. He says, with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God, for God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few, for a dream comes with much business and a fool's voice with many words. Now watch, when you vow a vow to God, do not delay paying it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. And we're not going to take the time, but you could run references on that. There are several passages where God's word says something just like this. God takes vows seriously. When you obeyed the gospel, that was a serious situation. And even after that, through life, when you make promises to God through prayer or whatever it is, you know, you have to follow through on it and keep your vow. One thing we could say, whatever the vow was that Jephthah made, we know he fulfilled it. It was difficult one way or the other. And that says something about the man, that he kept his vow. As foolish as it was, he didn't back down from it. And so we have to appreciate him for that. But vow keeping, let's learn a little something. All right, let's get back to Judges then and move forward just a little bit. Let's go into the final chapter here at chapter 12. And there's not a whole lot here, but something that is kind of important as we read this. First of all, as we look at this, we see at verse 1, the tribe of Ephraim comes to play again. And so it says that the men of Ephraim were called to arms. So Jephthah had all kind of trouble. He's defeated the Ammonites, but, you know, he didn't completely wipe them out. They're still an enemy to the west of him or to the east of him. And so, you know, he has to deal with them. There are other Canaanite tribes that don't really feel highly. They don't just love the Israelites. They all kind of despise them. But now you have Ephraim. And Ephraim, that, as you know, is a tribe of God. Like, they should kind of be in fellowship, so to speak. You know, they're the same people. They're people of God. And now he has to worry about them too, because Ephraim, that was a tribe that was a mess. They were carnal and arrogant. And they, you know, you think about Galatians 5 and the works of the flesh. And Paul talks about things like jealousy and outburst of anger and those kind of things. And that was Ephraim. Ephraim's been holding a grudge for a long time. You and it's just interesting right here where it says the men of Ephraim were called to arm. Well, that's what it said about the Ammonites. Remember, they were called to arms. Now here's a tribe, they're called to arms to attack Jephthah. For what? Something silly. It says, they were called to arms and they crossed the Zaphon, and they said to Jephthah, why did you cross over to fight against the Ammonites and did not call us to go with you? You recognize that? Didn't they do the same thing to Gideon? Remember that? He didn't call them in the beginning. They didn't have part in the first part of overcoming the Midianites, and but they were used kind of for the mopping up, and so they were angry at Gideon. And remember, he was kind of diplomatic and basically flattered them. Said, "Oh, you're much greater than I am and my tribe, and we may have overcome the army, but you overcame the princes of Midian, and you know, just basically saying you're far greater than we are." And they, "Oh yeah, that's right." And then they were good, but evidently they weren't good. That solved that situation right then, but they were just this prideful kind of people that held grudges. That's like 50 years ago or so. And so now they come back at Jephthah, and it's the same thing. They're angry about the same thing. The problem is Jephthah is not Gideon. And that's a problem for them. Because while we have seen with him, he can be diplomatic if he wants to. But you're going to come at him as if... In fact, these guys are out of control. Listen to what it says next. It says, we will burn your house over you with fire. Really? That's kind of a, they got carried away there, didn't they? Was that called for? They were going to murder Jephthah because he didn't invite them to the fight. Burn his house down. I mean, that's, you know, overkill. Did they forget he's a mighty man of war, a mighty warrior? I guess they did. Because watch what he does. Jephthah said to them, I and my people had a great dispute with the Ammonites. And when I called you, you did not save me from their hand. And when I saw that you would not save me, I took my life into my hand and crossed over against the Ammonites, and the Lord gave them into my hand. So he has to correct them a little bit. Well, hey, maybe you didn't get the memo or something, but I wanted your help. I needed your help, and we called, but you didn't come. So we had to go it alone. And of course, the Lord was with us and gave us the victory. But now watch. It says, and Jephthah gathered all the men of Gilead and fought with Ephraim. And the men of Gilead struck Ephraim because they said, you are fugitives of Ephraim, you Gileadites. And in the midst of Ephraim and Manasseh, and the Gileadites captured the fords of Jordan against the Ephraimites. And when they had any, now watch this, this is very interesting. It says, and when any of the fugitives of Ephraim said, let me go over, the men of Gideon said to him, are you an Ephraimite? And when he said, no, because now, you know, they're overwhelming them. Jephthah's a great, great warrior. There was no question but that he was going to win this battle. And so now they're defeated. They're trying to sort of sneak away and escape. And so are you an Ephraimite? When they said no, they said to him, then say Shibboleth. And he said, Cibola. For he could not pronounce it right. So that's very interesting. That, I mean, this is what their life came down to. A matter of how they said a word. Like, if you think about, if you notice the different spelling there. The Hebrews had a letter that was, it was called Shin, and it was their letter for Sh. But then they had another letter, Samach is what it's their letter, their S letter. And evidently, you know, like when we try, even that word, Shamak, they say Shamak or whatever. So not everyone can say that without practice. And evidently, they didn't do that. It was known. The Ephraimites, you know, they say things. They talk kind of different. You ever been around people who Americans that talk. I used to hold meetings in Virginia and a particular place, Ridgeway, Virginia. And they had one of their elders and several of their members, but not all of them. Even within the same congregation, they didn't all have the same accent. But there was a couple of them, one of the elders. I couldn't even understand him. He had such a deep southern accent. I mean, I would have to keep saying, say again. it was English. I couldn't understand him. And that's just the way, you know, Janice, I was laughing. You remember Ron, when he was here, what would he say? Instead of saying Missouri, what would he say? Missouri. And just that little dip. See, if he was before Jephthah, they just said, take him away, stone him. He said it wrong. That's what it was all about. Their whole life was based, the life or death situation. Let me see. We're going to test you. We'll see if you're an Ephraimite. Say this word. And he said it wrong. He said it with a Shamak instead of a Shin, and take him away. And that's just amazing. But now, you know, the important thing about all of this is simply this. These, as I said earlier, these are all the same people. These are the people of God. Now, this basically turns into a civil war, is what this is. Tribe fighting against tribe. Remind you of anything? We ever have any infighting in the church? Someone has said when the church is divided, that or a church divided breeds atheism in the world. That's exactly right. Even in so-called, you know, what people view to be Christianity, when there's a lot of division, denominationalism, the world sees that turns them away from God. It is a fact that some of the most famous atheists over the years, over the centuries, have been individuals who were strong members in denominational churches. And all the division turned them off, and all the different doctrines turned them off. And they became atheist. And so, I mean, we can see the importance of being united in Christ. Not turning sword against one another. And, you know, sometimes battles have to take place in the church. And the doctrine has to be defended, even if it's against someone who is a brother. But, I mean, we're not talking about those kind, like this was totally not necessary. A civil war. Why? Because you didn't invite us to go with you and fight. So lives lost, people killed because of that. And it does remind me of when brethren fight over the chandeliers or the color of the carpet. That's utter nonsense, isn't it? And it should never happen. Only the devil gains a victory when that happens. All right, well, the rest of the chapter, you have three more judges, Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon. But they're like a couple of the judges we've already come across where not much said about them at all. And so we're not, there's not much to say about them because not much is said about them. And a few interesting things about the men themselves. But, I mean, these were one thing to point out before the bell rings is that all of these now there's been five of them so far that hardly occupy any space, but they were judges. They were raised up by God, and they served for a while. In this case with these three, they served for 7, 10, and 8 years. And so, that's a period of time that they did things serving God, but we don't know anything about it. But they were still servants of God. And the lesson for us to learn is you can be a servant of God, even if you're not famous, even if nobody knows what you're doing, as long as you're serving God, that's what's important to Him. Not how popular you are or how many people know what you're doing. Nobody might ever know how exactly you're serving God. But if you are, He knows it, and that's what counts. There's one passage very quickly, and I'm sure the bell's going to ring here, but turn over to Malachi chapter 3. And here's a great little passage. In Malachi chapter 3 and at verse 16, listen at this. Malachi chapter 3 and at verse 16, it says, "Then those who feared the Lord spoke with one another." Now watch. "The Lord paid attention and heard them. And a book of remembrance was written before Him of those who feared the Lord and esteemed His name." Now you think about that. Like, God paid attention to them. And He pays attention to you. He pays attention to all of us. When we serve Him, again, doesn't mean we have to be the most popular people in the brotherhood or everybody knows what we're doing, what we have done. Doesn't matter. You serve God in your own way. As long as you're serving God, people may not know it, but God knows it. He pays attention. You're in the book of remembrance that's in God's mind. And notice, He says, "They shall be mine, says the Lord of hosts. In the day when I make up my treasured possession, I will spare them as a man spares his son who serves him. Then once more, you shall see the distinction between the righteous and the wicked, between one who serves God and one who does not serve God." That is something that God always knows. He knows who serves Him. Paul said in one place, he knows those who are His. And that's exactly right. And so we ought to think about that. Don't have to be someone famous to be a servant of God. All right, we'll pick up with Samson next week.